Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stomp TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's episode, Claire Copey and I are going to speak with Napa winemaker Steve Mathiasen about everything rosé. We're going to go very, very deep. We're going to talk about how it's made, the grapes that should be used in it, and also some of our absolute favorites in the world. Before we get to our episode, I want to remind all of you, our brand new Somm TV original film all about oysters, filmed all over the world, called The Oyster Farmer, is now streaming on Somm TV. Go to SommTV.com to subscribe. If you enter the code 50OFF, 50OFF, you can get 50% off a Somm TV subscription an entire year. That's $24.99 for an entire year of Somm TV, where you can stream hundreds of hours of original content you can find nowhere else. Go to SommTV.com and enter 50OFF. Without further ado, my conversation with Steve Mathiasen about everything rosé. It's an honor to have you back on the podcast. Steve, you have been in almost, every film I've made. You're all over Somm TV. You're a frequent guest on the podcast. Claire Copey, the audience can't escape you either. I'm going to call this a support group for rosé and talk about some gripes, how it's made, talk a little bit about the market. And I want to remind everybody listening that I've countlessly said on this podcast and on content that Steve and his wife Jill and their team make what I think is one of the world's most pleasurable, best rosés. And it happens to be made in Napa. It always sells out, which always pisses me off in about 2 months. So if you're listening to this podcast and you have not gotten it from them, go do that right now. I just want to start that off, that this these bottles go quick and they are an incredible value for the money. So, Steve, welcome to the Somm TV podcast and conversation.
Thank you.
All right. I want to start this off with, is rosé something that still matters as a world-class wine? Do people consider rosé a wine still, or have we diluted it to the point that it's not any longer?
Well, when we say people, that's a big term, right? Because, people who know that rosé is still a wine. But it's also like a beverage product. And I think in a lot of people's wines minds, which isn't necessarily a shame, I suppose, because hey, they're drinking rosé and they're enjoying it and that's fine, we don't want rosé to get forgotten about as a legitimate wine, one of the types of wine and one of the great wines. And so, this might be a little bit of a battle to maintain rosé as a legitimate expression of the grape.
I wonder too, there's a lot of rosés out there, especially coming from like very top producers that weren't made with the intention of making a rosé. Mm-hmm. It's a pivot sometimes. And I guess that's going to lead into a question that I have to start this off before we get into some deeper things. Is rosé profitable? I mean, is this a wine that is worth making at a high level, Steve? Because you make a high-level rosé. It's very affordable, but your rosé is very precise and very well-made. Is this a profit driver for you guys?
Well, we don't make a ton of profit on our rosé, but it's really important from a strict business standpoint. It's really important to us because it sells fast, and so it's really important just for our cash flow, because we're like farming like crazy right now, do tons of overtime in the vineyard, and our rosé from last year is selling. So it's great cash flow, but profit, it's more of a labor of love, I would say. Our rosé costs like a third of what our Cabernet costs. We make it, same place. So it's a labor of love that really helps on the cash flow.
This is a real basic question. We're going to talk more, but is it just as hard to make a rosé as it is to make a white wine, a red wine, any of these other just standard types of wines that you would buy?
Oh, absolutely. Rosé, it's a wine, and it's a wine that you can't really hide behind. Like delicate wines are really tricky because you don't have oak or sweetness or richness or any of that, or oxidation or anything to hide behind. It's just, so the balance has to be just spot on.
All right. Well, before we started rolling, you had a really fascinating conversation with me about kind of the market, and you compared rosé to craft beer. I want to get into this conversation about kind of the way the craft beer market happened and how to approach rosé as a beverage. What was your thought on that?
Yeah. Well, we're talking about like how rosé kind of has come up over the last number of years, and there are so many parallels between beer and wine and the modern craft beer movement with this push towards more IPAs, double IPAs, you know, super, you know, how many bitterness units can you stomach, basically? Lots of of richness and maltiness to balance the bitterness in these, you know, higher alcohol. And it's not dissimilar from, you know, what's happened in wine over the last 10 or 20 years of more flavor. Like, how do we pack in as much flavor as possible? Like more ripeness, more alcohol, more concentration, more oak to balance it. You know, like, you know, hey, our wine's balanced. It's 15% alcohol, but it's perfectly balanced because you can't taste the alcohol because everything's balanced because everything is so amped up. And that's been, you know, so it's been an arms race in the wine world. It's like it's been an arms race in the beer world. Like, you know, I'm doing a triple IPA, you know, like Dunkel style with, and I'm throwing freaking coffee in there. And, and you know, there's, you know, a beer drinker is like, well, but that's all fine and dandy, but what about refreshing? So now you're seeing like these delicious lagers, pilsners, Mexican style lagers, even light beers coming out of the craft brewing world. And it's really filling in the vacuum and giving people the refreshing beer that we've kind of lost. You know, like all the other, you know, not to disparage any of the other beer styles, but there was a period where within the craft brewing, what we lost was the refreshing beer. And so the refreshing beer came back and as a crafted product. So, you know, so not, you know, so, you know, a good craft pilsner is going to be totally different, right, than like a industrial, you know, mass market, you know, beer. And rosé is the same thing with rosé. So wine getting so rich, you know, whether it be like cabs or like big buttery chardonnays or like sauvignon blancs that are 14.5% alcohol. All the, it's like, well, what happened to refreshing wine? And, you know, and I really think that vacuum is rosé kind of grew into that, filled into that vacuum to give people something that's refreshing.
Interesting. I mean, for me, rosé has always been one of those wines that I'm trying to think of a good comparison, but like if you find yourself at like a wine event, a dinner, a party, and you know it's going to go a very long time and they don't have like Aperol spritz or something where you're like, all right, I have to have a drink, but, and because I know I have to drink 8 of these things throughout the night, rosé is kind of the next one for me. Generally, a rosé is going to be lower alcohol. I hope. I'm always frustrated when I find a 15% alcohol rosé and I want to, I don't understand why, but it's become kind of one of those totems for me where I look for that wine because I know what to expect. But I also, I feel rosé has almost gone the opposite direction of what beer did in some ways, because there's an argument to say that hops to beer is what oak is to wine. Mm-hmm. In that they got to this point where it's like, well, you could do 100% new oak, but you could also put it again in another 100% new oak bottle or barrel. Yeah. And then you have 200% new oak, and then it's a double IPA. And so, you know, I really liked when IPAs came out and there was this kind of new thing and they were delicious and wonderful. But then all of a sudden it was like, how psychedelic can the label look and how quadruple IPA can you make it? And I feel like rosé kind of went a slightly different direction. There just became a lot more of it. You know, right. I mean, if you put oak on a rosé, I'm out. I mean, I couldn't be more out on that idea. That is just a terrible, terrible, terrible idea. And I don't even want to be around anymore if somebody tries to do that. So, jeez. But with rosé, what I found was it became very popular. And so now it's a double-edged sword. I can go to the grocery store and they legitimately have good rosé. The problem is there's so many of them. What's that?
How do you find it in the sea of all the rosés that, like, a lot of them taste pretty much the same because they want it to be easy for the consumer to just grab it off the shelf and they know exactly what it tastes like. They know it's going to be this lighter style. Because when I first got into the wine world, which really wasn't that long ago, I was on that other end of the pendulum swing where it's like, we need this to be as light, pale colored, like, you know, just almost like watery, pretty basic flavor profile, which again, there's nothing wrong with that when, you know, when it's appropriate, when you just want something really fresh and easy drinking. But yeah, it's just swung so hard the other way and there's so much of it.
Like so much of it. I mean, the display, if you just just go into a Whole Foods. I mean, we'll take like a higher end market. They have an entire aisle of pink wine. And it is like, you can see it from 2 miles away in the store. And it is just this gigantic thing of Côte de Provence, Languedoc wines, all of this other stuff. And I'm kind of afraid that the whole rosé market is going to crash down on itself, because right now I think people look at it and they're only looking at what's the least expensive bottle.
Yeah, and then they see a rosé that's over $20 and they're like, why in God's name would I ever spend that much on a bottle of rosé without realizing that it has just as much potential for being a beautiful wine as a white, as a red, as a sparkling.
Yeah, Steve, how do we turn this narrative?
Yeah.
And how do we turn it from rosé is a large volume commodity thing? And just like you said, a lot of these bigger produced beers, there is a place for those too. I love a Pabst Blue Ribbon. I'm all over it. Mm. Especially if I'm on a boat, if I'm fishing, if it's hot outside, if I'm going to drink more than one, I love a beer like that. But at the same time, you know, how do you change the narrative that it's also worth trying some of these rosés that might be $35, $40, $50 a bottle, in some cases $100, some cases more, if you get into some of the really great regions. How do we change this narrative?
Yeah, well, I mean, craft beer has the same problem. How do you, I mean, Pilsner can cost more to make than an IPA because it's tying up a tank. And no, but people's like, I'm not going to spend that kind of money for a Pilsner. You know, my favorite beer on the face of the earth right now is the Hanabi Lager. It's like $16 for a bottle of beer, but it's heirloom barley that he tracked down in like Poland. It's the original barley and is contracting with someone to grow it organically. And, you know, he's keeping it in a tank for like 3 months that he built himself. It's worth $16, right? And so on the beer sites, there's all this pushback, like, can you believe that money for a Pilsner? So rosé has that problem. That it's not valued and it's not considered a real wine, and in order to change that narrative is just, I don't know how you change it other than if you're a serious wine producer, keep putting out serious rosé and just be uncompromising. I mean, you know, our rosé, I really appreciate you saying that it's a value. It's probably one of the more expensive rosés in Whole Foods. Because it's like $29, which for us is like really hard to keep it down to that for a handmade wine made from organically grown grapes that are grown for rosé. But it's so it's just this, you know. But so our attitude in terms of the narrative is just keep on keeping on, basically, no compromise, real wine, and put it out there and count on real wine people recognizing that, and you know, where they get some halo effect from some of our other wines. I think it'd be tougher if you were leading with rosé, but it's just, I think it's a time, because over time, I mean, rosé is such a new thing, and people will start to if you understand there's a difference between Hanabi Lager and a Coors Light if you're a beer person, and it's just a question. And you might drink both of them at different times and places, you know. If you're fishing with all your buddies, you're probably not gonna throw a bunch of bottles of Hanabi in your cooler chest out on the boat unless you also run a hedge fund. But
I do not.
But you know, it's just image. Yeah. So there's a time and place, you know, when you start talking less than $10 for a bottle of wine, like I just saw a thing on, you know, favorite rosés, and some of them were like $9.99. And I'm just like, how in the hell are you going to do that with organic grapes and any kind of craftsmanship at that price point? I don't see how that happens, but I think you need to be at least $15 a bottle. Eric Asimov has written about, you know, about his sort of threshold for when it turns into real wine. You don't have to buy the multi-$100 bottles of wine, but there is a point where something has to give if you get it too cheap. But one of the nice things about rosé, we grow the fruit for rosé. So meaning that you want nice big fat berries that are juicy, not small little concentrated berries like you'd want for red wine. So our yields are a little higher. And also the vineyards are further inland, so further away from the coast. And so the land prices lower as well. So we're able to, you know, it's not the same cost of fruit as it is when we're making our Napa Valley Cabernet, and that really helps. And it allows us to have that intention that we can, you know, we can say this fruit is destined for rosé, and then it's, and it's a totally different wine that, you know, rather than trying to repurpose red wine fruit and deal with the heaviness that goes along with that.
Right. So how do you make a serious rosé then? What are the steps to make something aside from the fact you're obviously starting at the dirt, but how do you make a serious rosé? What is the process of that?
So the number one thing when you mention about serious rosé, and this is the thing for, you know, that back to your point of changing the narrative, is that rosé is wine. A lot of people, I think, forget that rosé is wine. It's like a pink beverage alcohol, kind of not that different than like a hard seltzer or something. And it's like, no, it's wine. Mm. And so the first step is treating it like wine. In terms of balance, in terms of age worthiness, you know, all of the, you know, like the steps that you take to be careful because you're putting out a bottle of fine wine with a rosé. And so the only difference being is that it's a white wine that you're making out of red grapes instead of white grapes. So it's a white wine. Your rosé is a white wine. So white wine made from red grapes. And so thinking about harvesting, and in our case, harvesting by hand so that we don't have any oxidation on the way to the winery, thinking, you know, pressing it carefully. In our case, we use a champagne cycle and we do a really strict press cut because we're trying to make rosé with no heaviness or bitterness or like kind of like cloying finish. And so that means treating it kind of like sparkling wine in terms of how we process it. We want just the core berries. So again, from a cost standpoint, you know, you can press up to like 180 gallons per ton would be like maxing out like the amount of juice you can get out of wine, you know, white wine grapes or rosé grapes. For us, stopping at like 130 to 140 gallons per ton. So just, you can imagine that extra 40 gallons per ton is a lot of squeezing. And so you're getting a lot of stuff out of the skins and stems that you don't want, basically. So you make these choices that may cost a little bit more, but you know, it's part of the quality. And then and then how are you doing the fermentation? Is it a giant tank? You know, in our case, it's barrel fermented, so that adds a layer of cost, but it's a layer of control. And I think really important for texture, we use stainless steel barrels. So we don't get any oakiness or oxygen, but we get to barrel ferment at a, you know, the dynamics of a barrel fermentation are totally different. So a little bit warmer fermentation, and you have the lees right there in contact with the, you know, with the, that's all the spent yeast cells in contact with the wine. So they release all that nice salty umami on the back end that really kind of, you know, when you have a lower alcohol wine, where does texture and come from and pleasure? Because, you know, Claire, when you mentioned some of the, you know, like rosé can be watery. So, you know, a lower alcohol wine, you know, it has that problem with alcohol adds sweetness and viscosity and weight and length. And so in our case, the barrel fermentation really helps to replace that with that pleasure factor with the Sirlees aging and that kind of contact.
Yeah, which those mass producers are not doing.
No, exactly.
And you know, a lot of people will cite, and this is terrible because there are great wines coming from the Languedoc, but there are a lot of mass-produced, giant, almost conglomerate-like wines that are made, and they're on the shelves of every grocery store in America. And they're good. They're serviceable. They're fine. But like you said, Steve, these are not... These are not organic farming. These are barely an agricultural product when they get to your mouth. They are made in the process, not in the land. I wonder if, and I'm always, I mean, people who listen to this podcast are going to be like, yeah, he's on this again. But when I found the ageability of rosé, certain wines from, you know, from Provence, certain wines from, you know, the Bandol region and other places like that can age. And not only should be aged, you know, there are some rosés that some of them, they range in price. You know, if you're in that region, you can get bottles that are criminally inexpensive. And, but if you're here, sometimes they can be expensive, but they're kind of austere when they're babies and they're a rosé and they have a lot of body to them. They've got a lot to them, but when they're aged for 10, 12 years, they become a completely different wine. And I'm wondering if changing the narrative, because I do think one thing about why Napa Cab gets so much respect, why Bordeaux gets so much respect, why Burgundy gets so much respect, and why I think places like, you know, Barolo demand respect is because their wines often require aging. And that gives them this element of, you know, I think respect and people, you know. And so I wonder if teaching people that rosé can and in some cases should age would give a respect on this wine that it doesn't have right now. Am I making any sense there? Because to me, cellaring wine means it's worth keeping. And then all of a sudden you start looking at it very differently. You're like, well, this Montrachet is this and this Chablis is this. And you kind of give it more credit. You may choose to drink it young. That's fine. But it just knowing that if I were to hold on to it, it could be better. So I wonder if that's a thing, you know, teaching people that rosé can age. Can your rosé age? Have you tried doing it?
Oh yeah, you know the we've been drinking in the house. We drink like the 18 vintage, so it's, you know, it's 4 or 5 years. It has it's round, and you get things like cool, or the earthiness comes out from the Mourvèdre. You know, we have a lot of Mourvèdre in our rosé, similar to Bandol, and the Mourvèdre is, I think, in rosé is kind of like Semillon and like a white Bordeaux. It comes on a few years after bottling is when it starts. It's kind of simple at first, and then it kind of comes on and brings you that texture and that depth. You know, like, I mean, part of the definition of great wine is age worthiness. You know, I don't know that having to age is necessarily a virtue, but the ability to age is a virtue. And I think for as part of great wine, and, you know, like, to me, one of the things we want to demystify in, we haven't done a demystification podcast in a little while, but I want to demystify.
Yeah. We're gonna do that. You're gonna be back on for that one, but go for it on that.
Yeah, the idea of wine having a sweet spot, like, well, everyone wants to know, when are you supposed to drink it? Well, you drink it from year 8 to year 12, and you're just pulling it out of your ass, right? Because you haven't tasted that wine 8 to 12 years from now, so you're guessing, right? But I would make the case that you, as a winer, you shouldn't release the wine until it tastes good. And once it tastes good, now it's going to start its aging process. Well, it's going to continue its aging process because it aged before you released it right? And so you release it, you think, okay, it's good to drink. I'm going to release it. And then it's changing. And so the beauty of it is, it's like, your kids are, like, when you have kids are great when they're babies, great when they're toddlers, great when they're little kids running around. There's the best time for your kids. They're all different, and that's part of the joy of it. And to me, part of the joy of wine aging is checking in on it as it is evolving. And you go, you know, like, I love getting like a case of wine, and then every whenever period of time, year or two, just pop a bottle of it and see what it tastes like now. And it's like you have this relationship with it, and you're like, oh wow, this is never picked up on this other thing. Now it's doing this, but it's also changed. You know, maybe doesn't have the youthful, like, that nice crunchy brightness, but now it's getting into this other phase. And so that's kind of the idea on aging to me, is you're enjoying this sort of relationship you have over time with that wine. And that's in rosé totally, right? Because those young Bandol rosés are kind of, they have a little bit of a bite, and, you know, they have like a plumpness, and you don't want to maybe have them as cold as like some other rosés. And then, but they're really cool and great with like, maybe like, you know, grilled meats out on the, with rosemary and smoke on a, you know, like a, but like summer where it's still warm while you're grilling and you're having your rosé. And then maybe as it, you know, as it gets older, maybe you, instead of, you know, you want to have it more with like a stew or something, and it might even be a rosé you're having in more winter time. So it's an evolution on that wine.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, the kid analogy is good. I will say, though, there's never been a rosé that's talked back to me like my daughter entering her teenage years. But I will say, well, so what?
Because you're not making it. Our rosé talks back to us all the time. I'm like, oh man, punk.
that's very that. True. That's, awesome. That's very true. So what varieties? I know that there's. I always wonder if the Southern Rhone and the Provence and the Languedoc, like the Southern France grapes, do we make rosé out of those because that's what we're supposed to do? You know, you just look at, you're like, all right, Mourvèdre and Syrah in a lot of cases and others. Are those the right grapes to be making rosé with? Are there, should you make rosé with other grapes? What are the right grapes to do? I mean, are you using Mourvèdre because that's the standard? That's what people are doing in the south of France?
No, we use Mourvèdre because I like the earthiness it brings, the kind of mineral, earthy, kind of savory character to the rosé. So my take is there's no right grape for rosé. You know, we actually make for one of my winemaking clients, Conpie Wines, we have a 100% Cabernet rosé that's phenomenal because it's intentional. That, you know, like trying to force a Seigneur from Napa Cabernet rosé is going to be super awkward, right? But
Seigneur is, because that's a term people may not know.
Yeah, so Seigneur is basically with red wine, you're looking for, one of the things to think about is the skin to juice ratio, because the tannin and color are coming from the skins. And so the juicier it is, the less of that stuff. It's like how many tea bags are you putting into a pot of tea, basically. The skins are like the tea bags. And so sometimes people say, well, these grapes are a little too watery or too juicy. So as soon as you crush them into the tank, you draw some of the juice off so that now there's less juice. So the skins so you have a, richer, fuller wine because you have all the skins and less juice. And then it's like, well, I don't want to waste this juice. And I don't like, so no one wants to waste anything. And so let's ferment that, make a rosé out of it. Problem is that if you picked it at red wine ripeness, the rosé is going to be heavy. It's going to have, these rich fruit flavors and more viscosity and more alcohol. And that may or may not be what we're looking for rosé. For us, it's not what we're looking for. So we pick really early. So that's why when I made a point about we're growing for rosé and we put it right in the press and ferment it like white wine, it's totally a different mentality than a richer Seigneur rosé.
Makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I've actually, I'm always surprised when I have a rosé from a grape that's unexpected. There are, like Stoltman Vineyards makes a lot, they make rosés with a lot of Italian varietals that they grow on their land, grow on their vineyards in Santa Barbara wine country, and they're phenomenal. They are truly phenomenal. But like you said, they are growing them, picking them, making them for rosé, so it's not a surprise that some of these work so well as a rosé. I'm always just curious though, why those grapes, people seem to plant those, but I mean, that's a pretty good explanation.
You have in the 2020, it looks like you have a little percentage of Cunoaz in your blend. So what, I'm curious, like what for you was that decision?
Yeah.
And what does it bring to the blend?
So the Cunoaz is this really nice strawberry fruit character. Doesn't have a lot of acidity. So our rosé is the base of Grenache. Grenache, I love Grenache because it has like the really nice kind of texture, waxy, broad texture, and kind of almost like a little bit stony, kind of like a slate stone or something. And then the Cunoaz brings that nice strawberry fruitiness, and then kind of like crunchy strawberry, like a not the farmer's market strawberry, but like the garnished strawberry. Which you don't necessarily want to be eating as a strawberry, but for rosé, we don't want it to be sun ripened fruit because that's the sensation of heaviness. Crispy, crunchy fruit is more refreshing. So we have the nice crispy, crunchy strawberry from the Cunoaz, and then we have Mourvèdre gives you that's the earthiness and that kind of savory quality, and then we actually have Barbera. So that's our non-traditional. It's not it's the Strock Rhone and Rhone blend, but the Barbera gives you that nice spine of acidity. Barbera has a long tradition in California for like blending, for bringing the acid. And so it's that backbone.
I kind of liken Steve to like a zookeeper. He keeps a lot of animals. I don't know how you manage all of these grapes.
How many of these grapes are planted in Napa too, where, you know, most people are planting a good amount of cab and stuff? Like how much quinoa's, how much Barbera is there in Napa Valley?
Well, I don't think there's any quinoa's in Napa. So yeah, there's probably some Barbera left over. Remember Robert Mondavi, when he started La Familia, contracted some of the growers, one of my clients at the time, to plant Barbera. And the Barbera that they were doing, the Napa Valley Barbera, was so good. It's just such a shame that that never went anywhere. But so this is our rosé is grown in Yolo County, which is the next county inland, and that's kind of a farming county, much warmer, and that's key for our rosé, because to pick it as early as we do for those crunchy fruit flavors, if we were out on the coast, it would be way too much acid. And so the having the texture balance, it actually works really well inland where it's warmer. And that's another reason for rosé coming out of the south of France, because ironically, light, crisp wines work really well, and we're growing them in a warm climate because you can pick it early and you don't have to let it hang long enough to soften up.
Interesting. This just goes to show how many places are growing the wrong grapes and making the wrong wine. So, Steve, let's end this on, aside from one more reminder that the Matthias and Rosé, I love that you say like $29 a bottle is, you're fighting to keep it there, and it's a more expensive bottle. Guys, this is a like wine that punches George Foreman levels above its price point. It is an incredibly good wine. And it's one of the very few that like you can pour for anyone. You don't have to have them listen to this pod and be like, oh, there's an obscure grape in there for the strawberry flavors. They don't need to know this. This wine will pour great at anyone's table. It'll help if you know it. You'll just appreciate it more. But $29 is not a lot for a bottle of wine. And if you've ever seen the verticals that Steve and Jill are in, you know these people are no joke. They make everything by hand, probably to the detriment of their health and their sanity. So it's a very good thing. Let's end this on what should we eat with rosé? Because I think that's another thing with wine that elevates it when you go, it deserves the company of great food. Now, doesn't necessarily mean expensive. It just means thought out. So what are your favorite foods, both of you, to have with? We'll use your rosé, Steve, as an example, but Claire with a good rosé. What do you guys like to eat?
I'll let Steve do it.
We had it two nights ago. It's springtime, so I just made a orchetta pasta, and I took some fresh young artichokes and peeled them down and just sautéed the artichoke hearts, threw fava beans in there, bunch of spinach out of the garden, some mint and some ricotta, stirred it all up and put the orchetta in there and had that with the rosé, total springtime. It was phenomenal.
That sounds fantastic. We did something similar the other night where it was also, we did a pasta dish and a cream sauce with some sun-dried tomatoes, spinach, Parmigiano Reggiano, chicken, and it was lovely with the rosé. I love it with shellfish as well. Like crab and lobster, a nice rosé that has a little bit of backbone, a little bit of weight to it, and butter.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, we haven't talked about sparkling rosé, which is its own other whole universe. But on the seafood thing, I don't think you can beat oysters with rosé. Is completely underrated. And if you go to Brittany, France, they often have, you know, the wine they will just bring you is often a rosé, generally a higher acid rosé. But with oysters, it's phenomenal. If anybody likes mussels, like mussels and French fries with rosé, I think is probably really high up for my, like, I might commit a murder for it to be my death row meal. It is.
How are the mussels really prepared in this situation? I'm just curious.
If you're doing it like in France, they're doing it with lots of butter, some kind of stock, and then probably white wine. It's cooked in white wine or even in rosé. Just totally depends on where you are. But in Brittany, France, they'll do it. It's pretty simple, garlic, butter, all of that stuff. I mean, they make this stuff constantly. So the seafood's a good call. But, we have a show on SOM TV, which I still stand by. It's one of the more beautiful cooking shows I've ever seen. It's called Cooking with Wine. And there's one episode where Kate Hill, who's a very famous chef, makes a rosé glazed lamb. And she does it in her grill. She does it in like a terracotta grill. And the rosé, it's a bigger rosé, but it pairs just incredibly with lamb. And so when that happened, my wife and I started doing lamb with rosé. And it really, when you have like a richer rosé, it stands up very well to lamb, especially if, you know, you're not overdressing the lamb. So it's a weird thing to say that rosé can go with meat, but it works.
That bandol we're talking about, I can totally see that with lamb. And you think about how they eat down there, you know, just with the, you know, the Provençal herbs and grilling things. Totally.
Yeah, really tremendous. I mean, you talk about spring. I mean, the last thought is that I'd like to dispel that rosé, you know, real wine people know this, but it's not just for summer and spring. I mean, that's a ridiculous statement. Some of my favorite wines are when you're under a blanket and it's cold and the wine is also not, you know, it's not like a 15.5% Zinfandel like people think you want in the winter. For me, I like, you know, a cellar temp rosé type of thing under a blanket. I mean, I think in the winter, rosé is maybe even shinier than it is in the spring or the summer. So that's one thing I'd like to dispel.
I wish on that note, I wish that everybody could be given a sip of like a nicely aged Tampier rosé so they could see that other end of the spectrum, that it's not just, you know.
This is great. Steve, we're going to have you back on to do some more bullshit and wine. I know people love that and demystify some things. Yeah, no, it is for sure. And demystify some things. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And where can people get your wine? What's the website? Because this stuff always sells out. So act.
Mathiasen.com, 2 T's and 2 S's. We have it on our website. And also try your local independent wine shop.
Very good. Well, thank you all for being on. I hope everybody listening goes to the fridge or high-end wine shop and grabs a bottle of Mathiasen and I guess has some lamb. Why not, right?
Heck yeah.
All right, everybody. We'll talk very soon. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Claire.
Thank you.
I want to thank everybody for listening. Make sure you go and get a few bottles of Steve's Rosé. They always sell out quick, and so you might want to get on that if you want to get a bottle of it for this season. And also, don't forget, SomTV.com, our brand new film all about oysters from all over the world. The Oyster Farmer is streaming right now. I want to thank John Adams, who produced this episode. I want to thank Steve Mathiasen and Claire Kopy for being on it. And I want all of you to have a glass of rosé and eat some oysters, because that is what I'm going to go do. All right, everybody, be safe.